Welcome to this episode of the Think Wildlife podcast. Today I interview Neha Sinha. She started a career as an environmental reporter before transitioning into conservation. She has worked extensively across the country on various projects such as the Amur Falcon campaign and the National Biodiversity Targets. She's a famous nature writer and has published a book named Wild and Willful. This book explores 15 of the rarest species of wildlife in India, such as the plains tiger butterfly and the great Indian bustard. The link to this book is in the description below. All views expressed in this episode are personal to both the speakers and not affiliated with any of the organizations both speakers are involved with. Welcome, Neha, to the podcast. It's a pleasure to have you here on.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
You were an environmental reporter at the Indian Express. Talk about this role. What made you transition into conservation?
Thank you for that question. So I've always been interested in wildlife. I grew up in the city of Delhi, and even though it's a huge metropolitan city, it has a fair amount of wildlife. So we are on the Aravali mountain range, and there'd always be vultures, gyps vultures sitting on the terrace of our school and in government offices, just large old buildings in Delhi. And I saw that they kind of disappeared in the 2000s. And I was interested in journalism because I was interested to understand how the world works. And I wanted to develop some level of critical thinking with a sort of exposure to the way different departments or different, you know, sectors of the government, civil society, etc. work. So journalism gives you a ringside view of how society is really shaping itself. And while I was there, I used to actually cover environment for some part of my career. And there was a day when I realized that every single story of mine was negative, in the sense that it was about devastation or the sixth extinction or pollution or poaching. And I just realized that the thing that I loved the most, which is nature, wildlife, habitat, was just getting lost. And I asked myself if I wanted to write about it or whether I also wanted to be involved. So of course, journalism gives you the ringside view into what's happening, and you can write about what you're seeing, such as tiger poaching, such as marine pollution, or the shrinking of habitat in any kind of large project that's taken up by the state. But I wanted to see if I could contribute to the other side, which is actual conservation. And I gave it up to study a master's in conservation science. And ever since then, I came back to India and I've been working in wildlife conservation.
What have been some of the most prominent challenges and lessons from your conservation career?
So I've learned, Anish, that in a country like India, where you have many levels of governance, such as, say, a one panchayat, such as a state government, different ministries of the center and the state, you also have, you know, quasi-governance institutions like resident welfare associations, or like authorities that are made, say, for a lake or say for a park, etc. We have a very complex governance system in India. So there's absolutely no silver bullet. That's my biggest learning in conservation. So, you know, we might read papers from parts of Africa or parts of South America. We might even read papers from parts of India. But what happens in one part of India is completely different from what happens in another part of India. And just within India, there are thousands of Indias. So the first complexity is that it's really complex. And if you're solution-oriented, like some of us try to see if we can find solutions to pressing environmental challenges, it means that you need to find consensus amongst all these different stakeholders. So consensus building takes a really long time. And the second thing that I find is that it's really important to take everybody along in conservation. So, you know, we have all these debates in conservation now about how we need to work better with communities, how the typical conservation model in India has excluded many people, including the historically marginalized. So there's no way that conservation today, modern conservation, can look away from the fact that we need to take everyone along. And taking everybody along is something that takes time. So the second lesson is that conservation takes time. You cannot hurry the process. You should not hurry the process. It has to be, in the end, sustainable. And I think the final lesson that I learned from conservation in India is that you're constantly being surprised. Like, you might think that something is locally extinct. You might think that, you know, you might give up because what you're working on isn't really working out. And a tiger will walk into someone's bedroom and there'll be a cobra in a train, and there'll be a clouded leopard sighting. You'll find, you know, animals just making their way, negotiating their paths through this huge country, and you'll always be surprised. So I think what I'm saying is that there are no easy answers, but it's also an exciting and challenging space. These are my biggest learnings.
And what about the challenges?
So the challenge, as I said, is really to be able to take everybody along, to make sure that people don't feel dissatisfied or the marginalized are not further weakened by conservation processes. So if you're making, say, a protected area, or you're making some kind of scheme for conservation of a species, we have to make sure that people who live there, that people who are stakeholders, must not feel left behind. So it's really important to get every voice into the room. And it's really important to at least find some equity for these voices, that is to value the voices that are coming in. So, for example, in the Amur Falcon project that I ran for many years in Nagaland, the idea was, the problem there was the hunting of Amur falcons, which are a migratory insectivorous falcon that come to India for a few months of the year. And they come here on their migration path. They come here to basically fuel up, that is to eat a lot and to get fat and then move on to Africa. So that's a community that's hunting the falcons in one part of Nagaland. And they're also hunted in Manipur and Assam by different communities. And now the point, of course, it's illegal to hunt wild animals in India as per the Wildlife Protection Act. But, you know, the point is not to go there and tell them what to do. The point is not to become, you know, an arm of the police. We are not the police. Civil society is not the police. For me and for our team, the idea really was to put all the cards on the table and help the people decide for themselves what it is they wanted to do. And therefore, to take that community along, to ensure that what we were doing was participatory. That is, we were trying to create an education and outreach program which took into account the lives of those people, the villagers, and we were trying to create something that was exciting that they would want to be part of. We were not trying to go there with a stick and telling them you're breaking the law, how can you do this? It was more of a participatory approach, and participation takes time. Consensus building takes time. So that's one of the biggest challenges that we face. And it's a very good challenge to have because it makes us more nuanced people in civil society. The second challenge, of course, is the fact that environment is still seen as something that can be sacrificed for development. So we have huge projects that are coming up everywhere in every part of the mainland and the islands, which think that it's okay to destroy the environment as long as you get a shiny project at the end of it. This despite facing climate change, extreme weather events, storms, cyclones, all of that, we still are not looking at our natural systems as a way to have more resilience. We are still not looking at wildlife and habitat as something that should be protected for its own sake, for its intrinsic value. I think we still look at forests as something that can be cut down, or mangroves as something that can be destroyed, as long as it's in lieu of the development path that the country has set. And the point here is not to pick holes in a development path. Every government in every decade has wanted development for India. The point is, how can we converge on environmental safeguards, environmental protection, along with development? There are ways to do both. And I think the climate summit and the global biodiversity framework recently concluded say the same things, that you can use nature-based solutions for many, many things. You don't need to always have an engineering solution for developmental issues, but there is a need for greater convergence. I think environment is still seen as something that can be sacrificed.
You also helped with the development of the national biodiversity targets for the government of India. What was this about?
So the government of India is part of this CBD, which is the Convention on Biological Diversity, in which we kind of keep doing, along with many other countries of the world, the various ways that CBD can be implemented, the Biological Diversity Convention. Under that, we were supposed to have these biodiversity targets for India, which are to do with agricultural biodiversity and wildlife and habitat and how much of land to protect and how much of sea to protect, etc. So now these targets are going to be made again, but I was part of the process in my previous organization in that I worked with the Ministry of Environment and Forests, along with a whole bunch of other stakeholders, to try and find which are the best targets that India can have, which are representative of our country. So, for example, targets for conserving forests, targets for conserving wetlands, targets on reducing invasive alien species, which are destroying wetlands and terrestrial ecosystems. These are just some examples. And right now, also, different states of India are working on biodiversity action plans. This is still something that's being made. Again, we want some kind of convergence. So it's not just about protecting wildlife. It's not just about protecting a tiger and, its forest. It's also about seeing what we can do for areas that are outside protected areas. It's also about seeing how we can look at biodiversity conservation as a goal when we do other things, such as irrigation, such as land planning, such as having cities which are blue and green spaces, for example. So that was one set of targets. Now it has to be updated again as the CBD negotiations continue, and me and my colleagues will be part of the next set of processes as well.
Recently, the State of India's Birds Report was published. Its major findings were that 178 species of birds were classified as high conservation concerns. So, firstly, what was this report about, and what are the conservation implications of the report? What can be done about it?
So the State of India's Birds, or the SOIB, is the largest of its kind report, which looks at how birds in India are doing. So we have over 1,300 bird species in India, and that's a lot of species. For example, Project Tiger focuses mainly on the tiger and some animals the tiger is dependent on, such as prey species. But 1,300 within a particular taxa is a lot. There is no way that we could have a complete assessment of all birds to everyone's satisfaction. So what we've done now is that we have taken citizen science data from eBird. This is a coalition of over about 13 institutions in India. Some of them are government institutions, some of them are civil society, some of them are kind of more think tank organizations, and we've come together to analyze tens of thousands of databases, bird lists on eBird, to understand the distribution and the status of birds in India. And we found that, as we had suspected, that over 170 bird species need immediate conservation attention. A lot of the birds that we thought were fairly common actually have turned out are not so common anymore. And a good example of that is the Indian roller, which, it's kind of synonymous with open countryside. It's always sitting on electric wires and poles, etc. But it's not doing so well. So sightings have really gone down for the Indian roller. Similarly, the pied kingfisher, seen so often in wetlands, doesn't seem to be that common anymore. But worryingly, we also find certain groups of or guilds of birds not doing well. One is raptors, which is birds of prey. They're not doing well because they seem to be getting poisoned. They get electrocuted. And there could be other problems if we don't know. The scope of the report is just to find status, and we haven't gone into the reasons as to why a bird isn't doing well. That'll take a larger research project. But also birds of grasslands are not doing well. And you know, perhaps that is something we saw coming because grassland species overall are not doing well, and grasslands are still not considered important ecosystems in their own right. They're often converted to other forms of land use. And I think the conservation implication really is that things that we consider common may not be so common always. So it's important to also pay attention to things that we think are really abundant, such as the roller and such as the pied kingfisher, etc. It's good to use birds as a barometer to see how ecosystems are doing. We need more research as to why these birds are going down. We need to understand what is the state also of habitat. I think it's about time we should have sort of index for ecosystems in India to see how they are doing, which we don't have at the moment. And finally, it also shows us how important citizen science can be and how important trust-based coalitions can be, because this is a huge project, as I said, you know, because it's a very, very large database. And because we have so many different kinds of bird species, possibly this is something an institution cannot do by itself. And there are limitations to citizen science, which is why the report has a very important conservation implication, which is that we need more research on specific birds, on specific habitats. And we hope that that can happen based off our report. And we also need to focus our conservation attention outside, you know, places that have always been protected, like tiger reserves or national parks. So birds are everywhere, pretty much. And there has to be a focus on coastal areas, on grasslands, and areas that are frequented by raptors, because these are the groups that are not doing well today.
Over the last few years, we have seen that two of the major conservation laws have been amended. These
Yeah.
are the Biodiversity Act and Wildlife Protection Law. What were the key amendments to these laws, and what are the implications for conservation?
All right. So the Biodiversity Act looks at how biodiversity can be conserved, how biodiversity can be used as well. So the use, for example, of medicinal plants or medicinal, you know, other kinds of things that come that people are using in Ayurvedic industry or pharmaceutical industry, how it can be regulated. So it deals with the state biodiversity boards. It deals with how biodiversity information can be stored and collected through things such as the People's Biodiversity Register. So the changes to the Biodiversity Act are quite wide-ranging. And while it's too early to really see the impact of the changes, the fact is that we fear that there has been dilution of some of the provisions of this act, because it basically makes it easier for people and small organizations to take biodiversity resources, biological resources, which are used in industry, which are used in things like you know, traditional medicines. So you know, one really has to understand that some biological resources do not grow anywhere else but in a forest, for example. It's absolutely impossible to replicate the conditions under which, say, particular herb or a particular medicinal sort of you know, some component is growing. So it is important. While sustainable use is extremely important, it really needs to remain sustainable. And there has to be, you know, a carrying capacity study, or there has to be a study of how much you can take without actually harming the ecosystem. And this is something we have to reconcile with. So the changes to the act have to be monitored, but this is a concern that a lot of biologists have. The Wildlife Protection Act has been amended primarily to accommodate the CITES, which is the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species. So we are a member of the CITES, which basically is the kind of large convention, international convention that will say that you can't, sell tiger parts, you can't trade in ivory, those kinds of things. You shouldn't have shark fin. I mean, some countries have it and some countries don't. So we needed a domestic legislation to reflect the fact that we are members of CITES, and that's primarily the reason why the Wildlife Protection Act was amended. It also has an updated schedule. So the meat of the Wildlife Protection Act are its schedules in which different wild animals and plants are listed. So the tiger, for example, is Schedule 1, the elephant is Schedule 1, and these schedules needed to be updated because a lot of wild species have been discovered since the 1970s when the Primary Act was written. And those needed to be included in the act, and they needed to be represented really in the legal jargon, and that has been done. So a lot of birds today are protected under the first schedule of the act. And depending on how you look at it, that's good and it's bad. Some researchers fear that it makes research more difficult because it's harder to get permits to handle those birds. So ideally, what would be great is if the Wildlife Protection Act had a chapter or had a provision for scientific research in which it's made clear that a scientist who's catching a bird to ring the bird or catching an animal to put a satellite collar on that animal is not the same as a poacher who would be catching an animal for a nefarious reason. So about 200 of scientists had actually, made an appeal for having more enabling provisions for scientific research and to ensure that the taxa that various people are working on do not get, in the protectionist spirit, scientific research should not be hindered. Finally, the Wildlife Protection Act has a new clause on invasive species, which is very, very welcome because invasive species, as I mentioned earlier, they're just basically creating havoc everywhere. So everybody knows Lantana camara, for example, which is an invasive, but there are also so many more now. There's Senna spectabilis, there's the Parthenium, there are whole bunches of invasive fish in waters that we don't even know of. And it was really important to be able to tackle invasive species on a war footing. So, for example, today you can easily purchase a Lantana camara anywhere at a nursery. And people, like normal people, common people, civilians have no idea that this is like a biological, it's a biological catastrophe waiting to happen. And now that it's part of the Wildlife Protection Act, hopefully the state can begin drawing up a larger strategy on how to tackle and finish invasive species where possible and manage them where it's not possible to completely remove it. And it should become part of larger society. In the way everybody in India knows that you can't hunt a tiger, everybody should get to know that these are the invasive species that you should not bring into your homes, your gardens, your plates, and it should completely be banned. So that's a very welcome move in the Wildlife Protection Act.
Let's move on to nature right in India, especially with climate fiction and non-fiction. Are we witnessing a revolution in nature writing in India?
Thanks for that question. This is a topic very close to my heart because I kind of grew up reading nature fiction, nature writing, which was not India based. So a lot of the Indian stuff was very shikar literature. So you remember Jim Corbett and Kenneth Anderson, etc., talking about how they go to a forest and they shoot a tiger or a leopard, and that's one way of looking at wildlife. That's one way of conquering the wild. It's a very white view, right? So I always thought that nature writing was very, almost like masochistic in its appeal. A lot of people like the thrill of the chase, but it also framed the animal as a aggressor. Usually the animal is the bad guy because it's either exoticized or it's made into a villain, it's vilified. So right now, I think we're actually in the middle of a nature writing revolution. There's so many authors that I could name who really write with a local sensitivity towards flora, fauna, and also the links that people have to nature. I mean, there's Janice Pariyat, there's Yuvan Aves, there's this guy called Mihir Vatsa, who's written a book called Tales of Hazaribagh. And these are all memoirs, which memoirs are other forms of writing which touch upon people and their relationship to nature. So not just wildlife, but also the landscape, also the place they stay in. What makes a place, you know? So often in India we talk about historical monuments, for example, or the food, you know, being something that makes India what India really is. But many others also do feel India is what it is because of its landscapes. It's, you know, its mountains, its ridges, its forests. And it, you know, finally that started coming in literature. And if you follow Amitav Ghosh's writing, he has done so much work since the last couple of decades on nature, in which he writes both nonfiction and fiction. He wrote this lovely book called Climate, no, The Great Derangement, which looks at how we have this amnesia when it comes to climate. But he also has this fabulous set of books set in the Sundarbans, which talk intimately about the land, about the pressures of storms and climate on the land. And now you have a couple of new books which are also great. So you have Aarti Kumar Rao's Margin Lands, which I highly recommend. You have Bijal V, who writes a lot of climate fiction for young adults and children. So I think the moment has finally come. What I'm trying to say is, I think the time of Shikar literature is finally over. And I must also mention Rohan Chakravarty, the cartoonist here, who's already written books as well. Not just it's not just, you know, comics that he does. And I think I was speaking to Rohan once, and he said to me that when he was growing up, he knew what Yellowstone was. Everybody knows what Yellowstone was, but every Indian kid doesn't know Perambekulam, or doesn't know, like, say, Kanchenjunga. I'm sure you'll agree with me. So, you know, we know grizzly bears, for example, but I don't think everybody knows sloth bears. And there has been a huge gap in communicating what we have in India. And I hope that gap is finally being bridged. So I think it's an exciting time, and I think I have a lot of hope that this will become more mainstream, more popular, and people will have a nature writing shelf in their bookshelves, like in the way that you have in some other places abroad.
Talk about your own book, Wild and Willful.
I wrote Wild and Willful during the pandemic, and I think I've been thinking about this book for a long time, and it's basically, it tells the story of 15 Indian wild species and what they really need from us. It's just drawing a portrait of these animals, and it's a mix of animals that you know and animals you've never heard of. And that's on purpose, because I want people to be surprised by what we have in this country. So you, of course, have the great Indian bustard, which is down to about 100 birds, huge, gigantic bird that lives in the desert and grasslands. And I don't know if, you know, it will make it, because it's really dwindling. The habitat is getting completely destroyed by electric wires, which electrocute the bird. There's the tiger, the elephant, the leopard, but there's also the fluffy tit, which is a butterfly that makes a small migration in India. There's also the white-bellied heron, which we probably have four of them in India now, and maybe about 60 in the world. So it likes these really clear flowing streams in high areas, in montane sort of areas. So it's a bird of Bhutan, Arunachal Pradesh. And I think what Wild and Willful is trying to say is that wild animals have agency. Wild animals make decisions based on you know, risk, reward, and their own judgment of a particular situation. And to be willful is not a bad thing. To be willful and to be a wild animal and a willful animal, we see it as a negative quality. We see it as a jungly thing, as something that needs to be controlled and governed somehow by us. But I think the book is trying to say that, you know, ungovernable animals are not an anomaly. And by drawing a portrait of the animal and what it needs in terms of its habitat and food requirements, how they live amongst us, I'm just trying to shed light on how we can involve or represent animals in our decision-making processes. So the Ganga doesn't belong only to us, it also belongs to the Gangetic dolphin. And highways don't just belong to us, they should also make provisions for leopards, elephants to cross. And we lose a lot of elephants, about 100 a year, to railway line hits or hits on the highway. And because they're such sentient animals, so deeply bonded with other herd members, it's really important as we expand our highways and our railway line system that we should think like an elephant. We have to find out the conflict hotspots. We have to mitigate the impacts of these linear infrastructures. And I'm not forcing anybody to love an animal, but by showing why I love that animal, why others who are featured in the book love the animal, the hope is that people can see the world a little bit through a non-human perspective.
So, what have been some of the most memorable moments from your career so far?
I think the memorable moments have always involved animals just surprising me. So seeing like a ruddy mongoose in Delhi suddenly on a day when I had a very big meeting with some government official, just also seeing how people have a real love for wild animals in our country, broadly speaking, and how that love can easily be kindled by giving them the right information. I am inspired by the fact that when you show somebody what the name of an animal is, when you show somebody why that animal might be important, people very often do learn to consider that animal as part of their life. And a lot of forest communities already have this understanding. We have a lot to learn from them. So in my book, I write about villagers who live inside Sarisca Tiger Reserve in Rajasthan. And they already know they have they already accept the animal as an integral part of the life, the tiger that is. And even when the tiger is taking their cattle, killing their cattle and eating, they would always say something like, but that's the nature of the tiger. The tiger has to eat. The kind of acceptance that many forest communities have towards wild animals is a kind of barometer for how we could be living our lives. Because in the cities, or if you're not living in the forest, we tend to look at an encounter which is outside our control as something that's linked to loss and violence. I think turning points for me have been seeing other communities who don't look at encounters always as something that's loss or violence. There's a kind of deep acceptance that they have, which is very humanizing. And I'm very inspired by that. And that's probably the reason why, apart from the wildlife, that's probably the reason why I chose to live and work in India, when one can basically go anywhere, right? And that is really something I would like to highlight in my work and in my writing. Not just the wild animals, but also the people who live with those wild animals and the kind of ties they have to the land. Yeah.
That was the final question I had for you today. Thank you so much for taking time out for this podcast.
Thank you, Anish.